with Dr. Pam Peek.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode 556 of the Bold and the Brave Her podcast. Now, today I'm joined by someone who's going to give us hope. Yes, that's right. It's going to give women hope. As you're in the career path, as you're in the workforce somewhere, doing your professional work, whatever you're doing out there, there's something very special about women as AI knocks on your door. So I'm joined by Leticia Vuitton, and Leticia is hailing us from France. So there you are. Vive la France, right? Absolutely. Now, who is Leticia? For people who may not know her work, because so much of it has been done within the field of the workforce per se, she's a writer and a speaker about the future of work. I love this. She's published 5 books, and she examines the intersection of age, gender, and demographic change in the workplace. And she's arguing that inequities tend to widen over time and that women over 45 represent one of the most undervalued talent pools in today's labor market. So, oh my gosh, I'm all ears, Leticia. So first of all, tell us a little bit about you. How did you get involved in all this in the first place?
Oh, that's a great question. Hi, Pam. Hi, everybody. Hey. So I used to have a first career as a teacher and then left that job and went to the UK and worked in human resources to recruit people, to recruit engineers in France. And that didn't work out because it was a company full of men. I had absolutely no agency. I suddenly noticed that I was the only woman with children. There were other women without children and there were fathers, but no mothers in the company. And I realized something. It kind of clicked. This is not for me. This is an organization that was designed with anybody but mothers in mind. And so I left that company and created my own. And so, you know, my own boss for over 10 years now. And I suspect I may be my own boss until the end of my career. And so 10 years ago, I created this company to do research on what's happening in the world of work, what's changing. And in 10 years, you can imagine, Pam, there have been a lot of different subjects, which led me to publish several books. So COVID was a big chunk of it. But even before COVID, there were other subjects like the sudden emergence of working from home and things like that.
I'm so glad someone's addressing this and the fact that women are undervalued and that we actually have superpowers that we were unaware of. So I stumbled upon your wonderful work. I've read your work quite a bit. One of the places I read it is through an online called Fast Company, which is fantastic. They really do a lot of top line work on all of the leading trends in the workplace. And whenever there's something about women, I'm like, oh, okay, you got me there. You got me at women. So what's this one about? And this one really opened my eyes because I think if you read the headlines, Wall Street Journal and on, you've got this sort of doomsday thing going on about AI, especially. I'm using AI now in a lot of my own work, and this is for editing and such, and some creative work and this and that. And so because I'm a professional already immersed in this, I'm pretty comfortable with it. But then I notice a lot of what you said here, and we're going to get through each one of these points that you brought up in the article, were really pertinent to me, for crying out loud. And I thought, okay, so I'm not a unicorn, that there's something going on out there in terms of trending, which I think is really cool. And so kudos to you for actually spending enough time to study this about women so that we have a much better feeling on a realistic level about who we are within the professional circles. I don't care if you're at the corporate level or if you're mid-management or wherever you are, there's something brewing here. Wouldn't you agree?
Absolutely. And the impact that the piece, the Fast Company piece had really surprised me and made me realize that there was this underserved audience of women really craving for such content, craving just to be seen. So I'm absolutely convinced there is a subject here that needs to be tackled and that needs to be given as much echo as possible.
Well, you know, what everyone out there in the Her Podcast land needs to know is that right after Leticia published this piece in Fast Company, Why Women Over 50 Are the Future of Work in the Age of AI, all hell broke out over at Fast Company. And within 2 weeks, there was yet another tranche of blogs that worked around that. And then they republished her piece too. So I think you're kind of leading the pack here and giving a lot of these authors an opportunity, an open door to express the same kinds of sentiments using their own nuances. And you used yours. So let's dig in here because this is so cool. So you have a number of points in this article. The first one is demography is on their side. Demography is on their side. So we're looking at the reasons why women over 50 are the future of work in the age of AI. So tell us about this demography thing.
This is something that barely anyone ever mentions, but as the population ages, and you know, the American population is aging, the European population aging, the world's population is aging, the proportion of women grows. So in France, for example, where I live, the proportion of women is, I don't know if you can guess, 52%. So not only are we not a minority, we're by far the majority. If you win an election with 52%, you would not consider it a small majority. You would consider it a decent majority. So we're 52% of the population. And the older you get, the bigger the gap is in terms of how many more women there are compared to men. Because we live longer, so there's this big life expectancy gap. And so, yeah, we're the majority. And our populations will only grow older, and this majority will widen. So we're the biggest talent pool there is on the labor market. There are so many women, especially over 50, who are underemployed in part-time positions, but who would wish to have full-time positions, or who are in positions that is below their expectations or below their capabilities, and they would want to do more, they could do more. So the employer who really wants to have this access to a talent pool that's not tapped enough, that's the one. That's the one. It's growing, it's powerful, and it will only grow in the future. So demography is on their side.
One of the sentences you wrote in that element was, companies speak often about talent shortages while ignoring one of the biggest reservoirs of talent in plain sight. And there it is. And so to your point there, women are underrepresented in the hiring pipelines, leadership tracks, strategic workforce planning, as you all mentioned, all of these pieces. And this is extremely important. Now, I just read the other day that there's a new trend, and a lot of women who are very much like when you said you started your company, they're like, I'm done with this. This is ridiculous. I'm banging my head up against a wall. I'm starting my own company. I'll put money on it that the mass majority of new company startups are actually now women founded. What do you think?
They are in many countries of the world. And also the average age at which you found a company is not 25. It's closer to 45 in a lot of countries, which means that it includes a lot of women over 50 who decide they've had enough with being an employee. They've had enough with the harassment. They've had enough with the lack of evolutions, the promotions, etc. And they decide they want to take matters into their own hands and actually become their own boss, which is exactly what I did. And I must say, it's changed my life. It's not easy to have this uncertainty about your future revenues, to have this constant fear, but enjoying the freedom, enjoying the autonomy and the agency is something that is absolutely unique, which is why I don't think I will ever go back to being an employee if I can help it.
I'm going to reframe that a little bit. When you said the constant fear, I look at that instead as a constant motivator and impetus to kick ass no matter what. And so you sit back and it's people who have it handed to them, right? Here's a corporate board role and here's a lot of money and sit on your ass for a year. They don't have any hunger in their belly. They don't have any impetus or whatever. They're not worried. They're not concerned. Whereas an entrepreneur learns to live with that. You live with that and you use that as the hunger that drives you to wake up in the morning with meaning and purpose and keep it rocking and never sit on your laurels. And this is true for so much in life. You don't have to be an entrepreneur. And by the way, not everyone is meant to be an entrepreneur. I've been working, as many of you know, for a very long time with private equity on Wall Street. And I can tell you something right now. Entrepreneurs are a different breed. You have to have a greater acceptance of the work and toil it takes to do that, and also for risk. But you tend to be smart and strategic too, and not afraid to make mistakes, because I don't look at them as mistakes. I look at them as lessons. It's like, oh, okay, what do we learn from this one? And there you go. So I love that demography is on our side. Many people don't know, and you out there in the Herb podcast land, did you know that in aging societies, it's women's demography, their sector that is actually growing and expanding. And so we need to leverage this and make this work for us. All right, now the second one, is women are veterans of career transitions. Honey, that's an understatement. Okay, so tell us about that.
Yeah. So we've been used to think of work and life as this three-stage thing where first you learn, you go to school, then you have your career, and then finally you can retire and enjoy the third stage of your life. And this three-stage life has never really been a reality for women, because sometimes they become mothers and so they have different stages in between. And then when they go back to work after having a child, sometimes the place they return to, they find is not suited to their new life. And so they change careers, they do something else, they become their own boss for a while, but perhaps they will go back to employment, but with a completely different job. Sometimes they face harassment, sometimes they face a lack of career prospects, and they will decide to change and do something else. Sometimes they have less to lose, because as they are underpromoted, and as they face a glass ceiling that is much thicker as you age, sometimes they decide, I have nothing to lose. I can leave it all and try something new. And try something new, because if you're stuck on a sticky floor with few prospects, you have nothing to lose. And you can go in a completely different direction. And so many more women, not just women, but many more women have these multiple transitions in their life and have reinvented this three-stage model and made it into a multi-stage model, where you have different moments when you become a caregiver because you have an aging parent. And during those years, maybe you won't be 100% dedicated to your career because there's simply no room for it. But then when you go back to your career after, for example, the death of a parent, you want to catch up. You want to do more. You're extra motivated to do more and to catch up. And so the fact that we've had all these career transitions, that women over 50 are more likely to have had multiple career transitions, make them a lot more attuned to change, a lot more capable of being agile, of being also capable of learning again, capable of innovating. If you innovate when it comes to your own life, you can innovate in other spheres of life. You can innovate for companies. Yeah, so you're at the forefront of what it means to understand change. And in a time like ours, when all we hear about is the fast pace of AI-induced changes. Who is better equipped to handle that change than women? And then women over 50 in particular. So we're obsessed with Gen Zs, as if Gen Zs held all the key to change. But in fact, when you're young, you don't necessarily understand change as well as someone who's experienced it in their own flesh multiple times.
I think women over 50 also tend to be at a point, I mean, I certainly went through it, where you don't care anymore. It's like, you don't like me? There's the exit, right? You get a different attitude, which is like you become a better advocate for yourself. And so you can pick up and move and do what you need to do. Now, in my books, Leticia, what I tend to use is one of the nice things, you know, you and I are both authors, is that we could just make stuff up, okay, in terms of new words and new ways to phrase things. So I call it A-squaring it, okay, adapt and adjust. Okay, women are really facile. They're really good at this. It's like, oh, the kids spilled something all over themselves. You don't just stand there and look paralyzed like, oh, what do you do? And it's like, shut up. Just go clean the damn thing up and then start all over again and then take it up from there. Adapt and adjust. Be flexible. Be facile. And that's what women have to do now. I'm really glad you brought up the issue about the kind of the dated way of looking at a career path. And that means, you know, it's linear. It's like, okay, you know, you grow up, you get married and in college, and, you know, and then you do the career thing and then you retire and everything's just fine. I don't know who dreamed that sucker up because I don't know anybody who went through that. Certainly not a woman who had any kind of level of career one way or the other at whatever level. It doesn't matter. Things are far more complex than that. And that's one of the reasons why we get so really good at adapting and adjusting. It's like, oh, okay. Because you could enter a company and the current boss is just awesome and they totally get it. And then the boss leaves for another job and then in comes a monster, somebody who's just awful. And then you're like, oh, okay, you know, I'm already got a foot out the door and I got to be strategic. How am I going to make this work one way or the other? So I love that we're so good with this. And everything in life, when it comes to lifestyle, when it comes to medical conditions, when it comes to really navigating the years, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, you've got to be facile. You can't just go, oh my God, I have brain fog. Well, yes, let's all calm down. We go to a menopause certified provider. They will sit down with you. We will have a conversation. We will come up with a strategy. You see, everyone's calm. It's all good. It's not like I'm paralyzed. No, you seek solutions, and women typically get an A+ in that because they're very creative in their ability to seek out, study, do due diligence on potential solutions. All right, now that leads us to another one. Oh, I love this one. They know how to learn. Ooh, so that's a third advantage of women. So they know how to learn. What are you trying to get across with this element?
Well, we've long paid lip service to the idea that we are in a world where we need to learn continuously and where lifelong learning is becoming the norm. But for most people, they're still stuck with that three-stage life model where most of the learning is done at the beginning. And the learning that you work with is always a little bit obsolete because it was acquired a generation ago or something like that. But that's not the reality for most women. There are the things that you just described about them being so attuned to coping with different issues during their life. They know how to reinvent themselves. They know how to challenge their assumptions. They know how to retrain for a new career because they're veterans of career transition. So knowing how to learn requires also this basic humility that you kind of know that what you do know, if you are aware of that, that what you do know can be seen as obsolete, can be challenged, will have to be reinvented at some point. So we're wired to think of every situation as an opportunity to learn, whereas men are wired and trained to see every situation as an opportunity to make decisions, to decide with this authority. We seek opportunities to learn. And I think in our day and age, this is really probably the single most impactful quality that women over 50 have, most of them anyway.
Oh, I love it. And you also said something that just really stuck in my brain. I mean, so much of this beautiful blog that you wrote was really what I call stickable. You know, it's sticking in my brain. You said life has not allowed women the luxury of rigidity. Explain that.
Yeah, the phrase means that when you know that no position is stable enough, let's say you start a career somewhere, then you have a child and maybe possibly a second one, and you realize that promotions you dreamed of will never happen because the glass ceiling has suddenly gotten thicker and thicker. You realize that whatever assumptions you had, you cannot keep having, that you will have to challenge yourself, put yourself out there, probably fight a little bit more. Like, to move forward, the amount of energy that is required is three times as much as a man to move forward in his career, in most of the cases. Again, I'm sure there are exceptions. So this kind of constant movement and constant struggle requires that you abandon the idea of rigidity, of being, yeah, so rigid when it comes to your beliefs and your assumptions.
So do men and women deal with setbacks differently?
They do. I think that this is one of the things that can be harder for men, because setbacks are challenge, especially professional setbacks, they challenge their identity in a way that is more violent because they put all their eggs in the same basket. Men put all their identity eggs in the professional basket because that's where the prestige is, that's where the money is, and they want to be recognized as a breadwinner, they want to be recognized as someone who's a good professional, and the other eggs in other baskets, like being a dad or et cetera, are of slightly less importance than they are to a woman who grows up with this idea that she has to put her eggs in different baskets. So she will want to be a professional, obviously, but maybe also a mother, a daughter, a caregiver of some sort, someone who plays a role in the community, someone who is helpful to her neighbor, a lot of different things. And all these different identities make it so that if you become weaker in one aspect of that identity, you have the others to fall back on. Whereas for men, the professional setback is extremely difficult because they have less friends, less friendships, deep friendships in particular. They're not as strong when it comes to reinventing themselves because they haven't been trained to do that. So in that case, I feel a lot of empathy for men. They're not good at handling setbacks, whereas we're kind of used to it a little bit more, and we have all these multiple identities that we can fall back on if one of the identities become weaker.
I love that whole issue of the multiple identities. And really in the corporate, well, I guess in the professional world, we call it talent stacking. And I love that concept because really, in addition to many caregiving and those kinds of roles, which are phenomenal and so priceless, but what if a woman also has a side gig? She's a writer. She's an influencer. She's a musician, whatever it may be. So that, to your point, when things go south with maybe a certain career path, she has other things going on in her life. It kind of reminds me of the fact that women have oft times, not always, but oft times, a wider network of friends, colleagues, that whole thing. So that, again, when she needs that level of support, she's got it. Whereas men tend to be like, well, I've got those two guys in my life. And that's it. And it's really well documented in the literature that this sets men up for a lot of problems, because if anything happens to those two guys, you're in trouble. And why is it so hard for guys to kind of reach out and do this and that? I'm not going to get into that. That's another podcast. But suffice it to say, we know how to learn. We can pivot. We, as you said, change sectors. We rebuild confidence. And when we have a setback, we try to look for that life lesson, right? Where's the lesson? So that gives you a more positive path forward. It's like, I learned a lot from that. How am I going to now apply this in my strategy going forward? Now, speaking of strategy going forward, when we come back, I want to hear all about this J word, judgment in the automated world. The Her Podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to Solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. And we're back. Okay, now, in your next element, you say women bring judgment in an automated world. What does that mean?
It means that when you have AI output, to be able to understand the value of that output, if it's relevant or not relevant, you need to be able to judge the quality of the output. And to be able to do that, you need to understand context. You need to be able to read the room. And how do you read the room? How do you understand context? By understanding interpersonal relationships between the people in the room, by understanding where the data comes from, by accumulating experience and using that experience to look at the output and say, this doesn't look right. This doesn't look relevant to me. So the more experience they have, the more likely you are to have expertise and to understand the context. So this is true for older people in general, probably also men in this particular case. But the reason why women may even be better at understanding context is that they are used to put themselves in other people's shoes, to imagine what that people might think or might feel. You are responsible for the well-being of others around you. If you are a subordinate, you want to put yourself in your manager's shoes. What might they be thinking, right? And that exercise of anticipating other people's needs, of imagining what they might be feeling, this is the biggest superpower to understand context, because you become really good at reading the room. There are those cultural differences. And one of the clichés is that you have like two very different cultures, like the Japanese culture and the American culture. Americans tend to always be very explicit. They say what they mean. They are not supposed to have to read between the lines. They are very explicit about everything. Whereas Japanese people, they're so polite. Everything has always been hidden. They cannot say something directly. A lot of things are hidden. A lot of things need to be understood. And I have this expression in Japanese. I found out about that recently, which is to read the room, to read the air. I forgot what the Japanese word is for it, but there is a word that says to be able to read the air. There's a lot of context there. There is a lot of things like tensions between people in a room and things like that. And this cultural quality that Japanese people have, if we were to compare men and women on average, we would find that women are a little bit better at reading the air, even American women, even French women, who are not as brilliant as Japanese women. They would be better on average at understanding what's hidden, understanding what's there. And this is the kind of Yeah. Another superpower that is especially relevant in the age of AI, when the quality is not to produce something, to produce an output, but to be able to understand what to do with it and whether or not it's relevant in the situation that you're in.
I think a lot of this, sort of piling on what you just said, is about women and wisdom. We kind of get wise over time, maybe wise ass over the age of 50, but wise too. You make a really good point here when you said organizations do not thrive on information alone. So no question we could conjure up our little AI, whatever we're using, and say, okay, give me the trending over the last 100 years for gold prices. I don't know, whatever. All right, that's information and that's cool. But who's there to have the ability to read a situation, understand context, weigh trade-offs, and anticipate consequences? That's a human being the last time I looked. I mean, you can absolutely ask AI to kind of contribute to that thought stream. But really, at the end of the day, the more experience that a human being has, the more you can actually, to your point, read the room and sort of see what potential consequences could happen to whichever pathway you're taking, and really depend upon wisdom. I almost would love to put together like a wise woman's circle with some real wild and crazy women like you and me, and then just sort of say, okay, bring it on. The Native Americans in our country, and I'm sure this happens in many other cultures, actually bring women together, especially in two different roles in their life. One, when they're still menstruating and they have PMS. You know how you feel when you have PMS? It's like, get out of my way or I will hurt you. And then you tell nothing but the raw truth because that's what's coming out of your mouth. The other one is post-menopause when you're kicking ass. You're like, I'm not afraid of anything anymore. Been there, done that, got the t-shirt. Let's move it along. And whatever happens in between is a little iffy. But during that period of time, you pick up wisdom. And there's just only so much AI can do because AI isn't human. AI cannot pick up a life's worth of wisdom, of experiences, of adventures, of epic fails and epic triumphs. All those things put together, all it could do is gather the data that's already sitting around out there in some mountain. Right? So that's why I think it's important to have that human touch. But your argument is that women especially bring this judgment to the table, right?
They do. There should be more female judges as well in the justice system.
We got judgment. Now we're moving on to women bring emotional intelligence to organizations. First, define emotional intelligence. We already know what an intellectual quotient looks like. But tell us what emotional intelligence is, because it's a term coined and kicked around out there. What does it really mean in terms of the context that you want to bring it up?
It's multiple things. It's the ability to understand your own emotions as you face different situations, identify them. It's not always easy because sometimes you can be mad but not realize you're mad and not identify that emotion as being anger, for example. It's also understanding other people's emotions, what other people's emotions could be. And it's understanding how the emotions in the relations, right, and between people, and how you can use them, sometimes even in a negative way, manipulate them to obtain something, or how you can influence them to make a situation better. And it's really an interpersonal skill because usually the emotions you get have something to do with a relationship. They have something to do with what somebody said or what you experience in a social context. You can have emotions on your own, obviously, but they very often will have something to do with a relationship and with something you experienced that made you angry, something that made you jealous, something that made you afraid, afraid to lose the love of a person, afraid to lose the respect of a person, etc. So this is emotional intelligence in all its aspects. And we know now, and there have been, as you mentioned, a number of studies also in the corporate world to focus on the importance of that, because after all, who's a better salesperson than somebody who has emotional intelligence? Because if you understand other people's emotions and if you can use emotions so as to trigger, for example, a purchase, which is a very mercantilist way of looking at emotional intelligence, but it's also why the corporate world found it so interesting. They understood that that's something that can also be manipulated, that's something that can be used to make business, to be profitable. So we understand that this is an important thing. What we don't always understand is how it's also important for people, not just for productivity, but for people's well-being, for people's sense of identity, for people to be more than just a worker in the corporate world.
You said something, again, another little sticky moment here, that women do sort of invisible labor. So what they're doing is coordinating, listening, mediating, caring, anticipating needs, managing relationships, and that these capacities are routinely undervalued because they're associated with femininity, ruh-roh, and because they are difficult to quantify. God forbid we shouldn't be able to quantify. Quantify prayer sometime and tell me how that went. And yet, they're central to organizational performance, you say. So it's interesting. These human systems are indispensable to companies, but they're undervalued. And I've seen this at work too. You've seen it, where it's like, oh, that's the way a woman thinks, right? And that's how she's handling that. And they kind of like blow it off like, you know, she's like my mom. She's like my sister. She's, you know, like most women are like, and it's never been given value, yet organizations cannot exist without it.
There are American women who wrote, five women whose names I have unfortunately forgotten, who just wrote this book, this amazing book called The No Club. Have you ever heard of The No Club? So it's...
Yes, I know
you have, yeah, exactly. And so they came up with the concept of non-promotable tasks. And what they explained that it is that in every job, women tend to take a bigger proportion of the non-promotable tasks at work. And these are tasks for which you don't get a promotion, for which you don't get paid, but that are sometimes indispensable nonetheless. And these include like emotional work, like preparing a little celebration for somebody's birthday, or somebody is going to leave the company and you organize this little party for them, this goodbye party before they leave, or just little attentions, little things, listening to other people's problems so that they can move on with their work. And it's just a lot of little tasks, little things. They can also include chores, like cleaning up after others. These are non-promotable tasks, and a lot of them have something to do with the emotions in the room and the well-being of others. But to that, you have to add the fact that most of the jobs that require officially a lot of emotional intelligence, like healthcare jobs, they are performed by women. And they are also undervalued in the sense that very often they came with a pay that is not as high as it should be, because the skills that are required is not as valued as, for example, engineering skills that are supposedly emotionless.
It's interesting that emotional intelligence, that whole issue, is so terribly important for everything we do in everyday life as well. And it's not like you need to have someone applauding you every single time you do something great. It's just recognizing how indispensable it is to the integrity of whatever organization, whether it's a corporate situation or heck, a church group, who cares? The whole thing. So it's important to honor that and respect that. And I'm glad you brought that up. And then another element is women's strength in intergenerational workplaces. And I found this to be quite fascinating.
Yes, there are going to be, or there are already, 4, if not 5 different generations in the workplace. And what's unprecedented is that there is a large number of people of different ages, because it used to be that the age pyramid had the shape of a pyramid. There were a lot of young people and then fewer people, fewer older people, and always fewer as you go up the pyramid. But now the pyramid looks like a bottle, something weirdly shaped.
A parallelogram.
Exactly.
Forget the pyramid.
Exactly. Forget the pyramid. So you have lots of cohorts, lots of age groups with the same number of people. And that's unprecedented in the world of work, that suddenly we have like a lot of 30-year-olds, a lot of 40-year-olds, a lot of 50-year-olds, a lot of 60-year-olds. There's even a lot of 70-year-olds, some of whom are still in the workplace. And that's really new. And why are women better positioned to make these intergenerational workplaces stronger? Because they are used to having strong relationships with people of different ages. They are better parents, are more involved parents than fathers, sadly. So they spend more time looking after children. They spend more time looking after grandchildren when they become grandmothers. They also spend more time looking after their parents, sometimes their parents-in-law, not just their parents, but their parents-in-law, the parents of their spouse when they have a spouse. So they are in there, and sometimes also in that sandwich generation when they have both. They have teenage kids and aging parents with a health problem, and they are very present for them. So on their day-to-day life, they spend time strengthening these relationships between generations. And that's something that can be translated at work, because they are not afraid of speaking with someone from a different generation, or perhaps less afraid. Perhaps they have a little, maybe not, but perhaps, hopefully, they have a little less preconceived ideas and cliches and ageist views of what different generations are like, because they are so used in their lives to caring for others.
Yeah, they do it on a day-by-day basis, which brings us to the next one, as we're almost done here, and that is women are often deeply motivated to contribute. And again, the sticky part of this one for me was that women are more interested in meaningful contribution than some kind of corporate drama. And this is the kick-ass part. They know what they care about, what they're good at, and what nonsense they no longer wish to tolerate. It's like, stop already. I've been here. And no, we're not going to do this. And so this really, I think what they're doing is cutting to the chase and just saying, look, this is the way I feel about it, whether you like it or not, whatever, here it comes. And it's based upon years of experience, up, down, and around. And this is my thought about how we should proceed based upon my own due diligence, et cetera. And I love that deeply motivated to contribute thing, because I also think as you age, as I said before in the earlier part of the podcast, when you wake up, you want to have meaning and purpose in life. If you don't have meaning and purpose in life, and this is true across the board, this has nothing to do with work per se, it's just in life, right? Then why get up? And this contributes to isolation, depression, disconnection. It's not good. So what is your meaning and purpose in life? And I think some of that becomes a little bit more, okay, crystalline. Now, remember, there's those two different kinds of intelligence, the fluid intelligence of the young people that you and I know so well. This is a very different kind of intelligence where the productivity is through the ceiling. Nobel Prizes are awarded to the people who did their work in their 20s and maybe early 30s. But as you get older, it becomes a crystalline intelligence, one in which now you're depending upon experience and wisdom. And I think this is where so much of this comes out. Now, this also then bleeds beautifully into your next point, which is women are agile in times of crisis. Go for it. What does that mean?
Well, we've handled problems and crisis situations all the time. So we're less we're less in a state of panic when we have to face one at work. I think we're used to finding solutions that are perhaps not the ideal one, that also require fewer resources, which leads back to what you said in terms of efficiency and productivity, because we're also much more productive. There is less waste. Being agile requires or also means that you can come up with something that is lean, that doesn't require as many resources, that is also more ecological. You don't need so much. If you are an entrepreneur, you're less likely to raise $100 million for your next venture. But that's perhaps you can do a lot more with less, right? Because you're agile and because I'm not saying we should raise less money. Of course not. Don't get me wrong, Pam. I wish there were no inequalities when it comes to raising funds in entrepreneurship. But what I'm saying is that we can do more with less. We know how to do more with less because we've been used also at home to handle tight budgets. When there is no money in a home, when there is little money in a home, it's the women who handle it. They know how to buy for less. In times of inflation, it's super hard, but they will always find a way. This kind of day-to-day agility is also extremely useful in the workplace. But to go back to motivation, there was something else that we need to mention. It's ambition. That's also something that's very much undervalued. And we tend to think of ambition as a thing for young people. Be ambitious. We tell 20-year-olds to be ambitious and it's fine. But in fact, 50-year-olds are very ambitious because they need to catch up. Sometimes the first half of their careers was disappointing, to say the least. And now comes menopause, and it's not the end. They want to accomplish things. So what is often said about age is often not gender neutral. There's this idea that in the first half of your career, you accomplish things, and then you can move on to just be wise and kind of on the side and not necessarily willing to accomplish things, like even like being successful in business and making money. Well, a lot of women in their 50s, I know, whose first part of their careers was disappointing, they want to do the things that 20-year-olds want to do. They are ambitious. They want to catch up. They want to do a lot. Sometimes they want to make money because they know they will need it.
So I love this. And as we draw this to a close, I want everyone out there in the Her Podcast land to apply everything that we were just discussing, as Leticia has shared with us so beautifully, to our own self-care. Think about it. We adapt and adjust. You know, our bodies change. Things happen. And we have to be able to stay the course and take care of ourselves. Otherwise, what's the point of caregiving if you're not doing it for yourself? That doesn't make any sense. It's unbalanced. It's incredibly unhealthy. But we have the superpowers to pull this off. We're agile. We can make this happen. We're wise, especially by the age of 50. We know how to pivot. We know how to read the room. As we get older, as we go through our 20s, 30s, 40s, you get more and more confidence about this. Never be afraid of falling on your ass. Just stand up, dust off, and move it along after you've learned the life lesson. What did you learn? How are you going to apply that? What's going on? Everything, all these points that I really got into with Leticia from her beautiful blog are really completely applicable to our own health and our well-being, to our health span, because we have the capability of doing this. We just have to be able to do the work. Do the work. Hello, work, four-letter word. We have to do the work, and that's okay. And then we balance it with plenty of joy in our life that we've created because we're the ones who are instigating here and motivating. And so I loved bringing this full circle now because it applies to our professional work. It applies to our personal lives, to our health and well-being. Each one of these points is that potent. I want you to remember them and come back to this podcast many times to refresh. And if you also want to just read the blog itself, it's under Fast Company, Fast Company online, why women over 50 are the future of work in the age of AI. I just found it to be exquisitely compelling. Leticia, I could talk to you all day. My goodness, you'll be our go-to for all things women in the workforce, that's for sure. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time out there in France to make the time, because, you know, I have to sit here with my clock and my production team going, what time is it over there? And oh my goodness gracious. But thank you for sharing your wisdom with all of us, Leticia. We can't be more grateful.
Thank you so much.
All right. And we've been talking to Leticia Vito, and that's spelled V as in Victor, I, T as in Tom, A-U-D. Leticia Vito. And you can learn more about her by going to her website. And it's a really cool website. Now, Leticia is spelled L-A-E-T-I-T-I-A. And then Vito, VITAUD.com, and learn more about her wonderful work. Again, Leticia, thank you, thank you, thank you for being on the Her Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Now, I want to thank my sponsor, Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs Rooted in Nature, and their new Her Life Stages products. Scope it all out at Solaray, Solaray.com. Now, take a moment and give us a review, because we love to hear from you. Oh, my God, I'm rhyming. All right. Now, this has been a production of Podcast Health, and I want to remind you that although your time on this planet may be limited, the things you can do with that time, as Leticia shared with us, are not. So get on out there and carpe diem. Seize the day. Thanks for listening, everyone.